Lessig. Alan is a longtime Zen practitioner, a writer, an accomplished novelist, amateur figure skater, gay activist, and former nonprofit director. He has been a guest teacher for our Sangha for more than 2 years now. He practices at the San Francisco Zen Center, where he received lay ordination in 2013. He also completed year-long Establishing the Path of Practice training conducted by then Abbot Paul Holler. For the past 8 years, he's led the meditation and served on the leadership team for Queer Dharma at the Zen Center. And he's practiced and participated in numerous practice periods and currently sits with the Black Mountain Zen Center in Belfast, Northern Ireland. His particular interest in Zen has been on how our practice functions and supports life in the world outside the temple. Alan, welcome.
Thank you, Carl. And thank you, everyone, for coming, and especially some of my friends here in the Twin Cities and elsewhere in San Francisco and Cleveland. And I also just want to start by thanking Daigon in particular, because we're not often in the same room enough. But when I first came to Zen, Daigon was the one who pulled me in to Queer Dharma and pulled me into understanding how we belong and fit in the Dharma. So thank you, Daigon, for bringing me in and supporting me for all these years. As Carl just said, as you know, one of my identities is a figure skater. And for 20 years now, I've been practicing, learning new skills and tricks on the ice. And for me, the ice is a source of grace and intimacy and camaraderie. I see it as a practice of the Buddha nature of mindfulness and of beingness. On my best days, like all practice, it can be effortless and a source of joy. The other day, after I warmed up, I entered the center rink to practice my spins. My sit spin is my favorite. That's the one where they go down low and spin around. And my body memory usually takes over as I turn on my left leg, and my right leg moves ever so precisely around the side until it's in front of me as I sink down and pull my arms in. There's this delicious moment when I'm centered, my body is all in the right place, and when I can pull in a little tighter and my speed increases until the rink becomes a blur itself. But on this day, none of that happened. I couldn't coordinate the movements. The more I tried, the worse it got. The frustrated, I tried harder. But just as in practice, pushing harder doesn't necessarily achieve much. And actually, it usually doesn't achieve anything. And defeated, I tried to move on. And this happens frequently enough and soon enough, usually in the same session, I recover what I lost. But what I noticed this time was that my mind at work questioning what was going on. And the questions were not neutral or analytic. The questions were about my very being. Why did I even think I could accomplish anything? And who was I deluding myself that I could even skate? And quickly they morphed into judgment. You are a laughingstock and you will be never good at this. You should just give it up right now. Everyone knows how bad you are. This descent into self-judgment and despair only took seconds, and honestly only lasted seconds. Normally, I don't think I would have even noticed it. But this time I realized that some brief shaming self-doubt was there, waiting for the right moment to insinuate itself. And in that way, it was a moment of practice awareness. As I was doing research on the origin of certain words for my novel, The Trouble Seeker, I discovered something that struck me as really curious. Linguists have proposed the existence of an ancient language that can be traced back to 4,500 to 2,500 BCE, called Proto-Indo-European, which is the origin of most European languages and Indian languages, including Pali, the language of Buddha. Many words such as mother, father, numbers from 1 to 10, various animals from wolves to oxen, can be recognized across hundreds of current and now extinct languages. But the word that stood out for me was shame. Linguists believe that the word originated in this Proto-Indo-European language as scam or came to cover, as to cover one's face. I found it fascinating that along with words for family members, counting, agriculture, hunting, our ancient Neolithic ancestors needed a word to express a feeling that seems deeply baked into human existence. The difference between shame and guilt is actually, the word appears in only the 1300s, is that guilt is an admission that one did something bad or wrong. There are actions that can be examined, and guilt is related to behavior. The noted researcher Brené Brown said, "With guilt, I can say, I'm sorry I made a mistake. Shame says, I am bad, sorry, I am a mistake." As Tim Burkett, a Zen teacher in Minnesota, said, "Shame damages a person's image of themselves in ways that no other emotion can, causing you to feel flawed, inferior, worthless, and even unlovable. In its worst successes, I've experienced shame as self-brutalizing hate, looking at a mirror and seeing nothing to love, an empty void into which I am endlessly falling. I feel the pressure of the world pushing down on me, punishing me, judging me. I feel an unworthiness so profound it cannot be revealed." And while shame may be attached to an action, it's the self-judgment that ignores the action that happened and says, "My very being is awful and unredeemable." For a few seconds the other morning on the ice, I briefly felt all of this. Left unrecognized, shame has been correlated with depression, addiction, and suicide. Unrecognized shame can also lead to one being defensive and attack and blame others for the same things that cause us shame. For shame to exist, we have to be part of a family, whether it be a family of origin or choice, or some other group of people that has some perceived commonality. Shame needs the comparison to others, and it emerges from judgment that one does not meet the stated or unstated norms of the group. Norms can be generated by family, religion, culture, background, education, class, and particularly in our time, and particularly in the United States, are overlain by norms held in society about race, gender, and ethnicity. These are powerful forces around otherness, who belongs and who does not, that can keep any of us from being comfortable in our own skin. Looking just at the gendered norms of our society here in the US, we can see what we're up against. I mentioned Brené Brown a minute ago. She's a researcher who has studied shame and vulnerability. Her TED Talks on these topics are an absolute must if you haven't seen her. According to a study, Brown quotes, "To conform to female norms in the US, a woman must be nice, thin, modest, and use available resources for appearance." With a focus solely on outward appearance, the implication is that anything else, which means everything else, a woman does breaks norms. And according to the same study, US men, to conform to male norms, a male must control his emotions, put work first, pursue status, and be violent. Traditionally, the norms of religion, education, and legal system have reinforced these standards and support the subjugation of women by men. These norms, I mean, I can only say they're devastating, spirit-killing, and indefensible. And public shaming is designed to keep one alone and isolated. Queer people challenge most of these gender norms, and especially those of us who challenge the concept of gender and gender identity all by itself. Despite these challenges, we can't help but feel the brutality of these norms when we don't fit or match up. As queer people, I think I can safely say that shame has been an all too common experience in our lives and in our development. Growing up and living in societies, communities, and families where our very thoughts and feelings do not conform to external norms, our recognition of our differentness easily converts into shame as we are told to behave in ways contrary to our being. Shame can show up in a number of ways. And this categorization I'm about to give is my own, not based on any science, but I hope you find it useful. So the first one is childhood or developmental shame. All societies, cultures, and families prioritize certain norms around conduct and judge individuals based on them. Conscious attention to norms and shaming by authority figures in one's life is designed to keep us in line with the expected behaviors of a particular group. And as children, we're dependent on others and powerless to control our circumstances. In addition, children commonly see their actions that they're the cause of all good and bad in their life. They don't understand the forces that are pressing on them. And so it's not unusual for children to feel fault for the parents' marital problems or illnesses in their families. Throw in punishing gods and verbal and physical threats for being different, and the process of internalizing shame is implanted in our bodies and mind at young age. Not only do we blame ourselves for things that are out of control, but we begin to notice what is expected of us and how our imperfections make us fall short. Our internal processing results in feeling shame for not living up to what is expected, being unable to live up to expectations, or being by nature unaligned with these expectations. We react in secrecy, silence, and self-judgment as we hide, remember that old word chem, to cover who we are consciously or unconsciously. The second kind of category for me is called incident-based shame. Specific occurrences in our lives may cause us to be overcome by shame based on our expectations that we grew up with, this developmental shame. How I left my last job fits in that category. After 6 years as a successful six years as a head of a nonprofit, my last 6 months fell into chaos with a new board president that undermined me in every way, staff that felt threatened by that instability she caused and turned on me, and my own inability to manage all this stuff. I started to lose sleep, I was anxious, and although I complained about the situation to my friends, I never talked to anyone about this deep-seated feelings of powerlessness and shame, whose story was that I was incompetent and always brought about bad things in my life and others. I judged myself harshly and without restraint. In the end, my dream of retiring with appreciation and acknowledgement went down the drain with part of my ego. And although I was able to take care of myself, I felt that the story I told others about my departure was concocted and not completely true. The months-long process that the board of directors undertook to approve my departure did not help me allow to publicly acknowledge what was going on, leaving staff to assume the worst by my silence, reinforced by the secrecy and silence and judgment I felt myself. And the final version of shame is the one I started with the beginning of, like, this momentary shame. There are times, brief moments or judgments we make where we blame our beingness as the problem and surrender to defeatism. If shame is so bred into humans, what did the Buddha say about this? Strangely, not lots. But I did find the Buddha gave us some guidance in dealing with our mind. And so in the Abhalatika Rahulavada Sutta, Buddha gives his son, whose name is Rahula, three steps for reflecting bodily actions, verbal actions, and mental actions. And so I'll kind of read some of that sutta and then I'll comment on it. So first, whenever you want to do a mental action, and remember there's verbal actions, bodily actions, and mental actions. And in the sutta, Buddha goes through, repeats all these over and over and over again. So whenever you want to do a mental action, you should reflect on it. This mental action I want to do, would it lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both? Would it be unskillful mental action with painful consequences, painful results? If on reflection, you know it would lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or both, it would be an unskillful mental action with painful consequences, painful results, then any mental action of that sort is absolutely unfit for you to do. But if on reflection, you know that it would not cause affliction, it would be a skillful mental action with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, then any mental action of that sort is fit for you to do. And by mental action, he's talking about feelings and emotions. Next, the second step, when you are doing, so first is like you're thinking about doing something, then when you are doing a mental action, you should reflect on it. This mental action I am doing, is it leading to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or both? Is it unskillful with painful consequences and painful results? If on reflection, you know that it is leading to self-affliction or to the affliction of others or both, you should give it up. And then finally, having done a mental action, having had thoughts and feelings, you should reflect on it. This mental action I have done, did it lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or both? Was it an unskillful mental action with painful consequences or painful results? And this is where I see guidance on dealing with shame. If on reflection, you know that it led to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or both, if it was an unskillful mental action with painful consequences, painful results, then you will feel distressed, ashamed, and disgusted. Feeling distressed, ashamed, and disgusted with it will help you exercise restraint in the future. So he doesn't say that it's a shame, but if you're talking about being distressed, ashamed, and disgusted by things you're thinking, and over he talks about, does this lead to self-affliction, before he actually asks if it results harm in harm of others. And I found that fascinating, that the guidance is check yourself first. Are these things we're doing, are they harming us? And then check that box, not harming us, then is it going to harm someone else? So that to me says we need to reflect on the affect thoughts, emotions, speech, physical actions have on ourselves. Through this reflection, we can determine if we are skillful. He first reminds us to reflect it in three steps: as we consider something, as we do it, and then after we do it. What makes this teaching incredibly powerful to me is the inclusion of mental actions, the formations of emotions and feelings. The Buddha provides us a way to see our shame and to work through it. I hear Buddha asking us to examine our actions that cause our own self-afflictions. He specifically, as I said, calls out distress, disgust, and shame as signs that we're being unskillful. So how do we go about examining the shame we carry in our bodies, and what can we do about it? We can start, and we can always start, with love and compassion for ourselves. Self-compassion is the heart of all compassion. Many people find it useful to chant the loving kindness meditation or the Dalai Lama's every day I wake up chant as a way to remind themselves that compassion and love starts in our own body. One way to become more aware of how shame affects you is to keep a shame diary for a week. Note down anytime you hear or feel yourself in despair, no matter how momentary, like the one I experienced. And then ask yourself, what negative emotions are arising right now? And then you can ask yourself, what just happened before this feeling that triggered this feeling? Is there a story that goes along with this feeling? Note these all down. Determine where in your body does this negative feeling sit. And then you can ask yourself, are there things I could have done differently? This helps us get out of the I am a bad person to what can I do differently that are actions that I can potentially change or reflect on. And finally, notice that if asking these questions changes the feeling or its place in the body. Usually as we reflect in this way, we start dissipating the energy, especially that something powerful emotions have, like shame. We already start dissipating that energy just by paying attention. So try paying attention in this way for a week, and you could see when shame pops up in your life and identify any patterns. I was really surprised in the last week, as I've been thinking about shame for this Dharma talk, how often, attached to completely minor difficulties or challenges, momentary shame pops up, along with a default response of me giving up and feeling despair. When I became aware of the feelings, I could acknowledge them, react to them, and start to let them go. And I'll be honest, even when I did that, there were enough times where I was able to notice there was still some piece of unloved part of me that wanted to still linger in this feeling of shame and pain. As I stated earlier, forgiveness and self-love are the keys to healing shame. A therapist I was once seeing mentioned that he read about Buddhist priests who spent a year forgiving themselves. With that mention, I started my own practice of doing the same. I began with one of my earliest memories. At the age of 3, I remembered falling down the cellar stairs after I tried wearing my father's work boots. In the original story that I carried with me, I am clumsy, I am uncoordinated, and I am stupid for hurting myself. Note the harshness of those self-judgments. When I sat with the story in this forgiving time, after the memory and some other feelings arose, and I focused the story on a different element, I focused on how I wanted to experience my father's boots, how they smelled, what they felt like in my little hands. I wanted to be like my father, a man I emulated, and I felt a power in putting on these boots on my little tiny feet. And then unexpectedly, I tripped down the stairs because the shoes were too big. I was not ready at age 3 to be my father. I was a child, and children try things that are sometimes dangerous. And in the next step, I forgave myself for not knowing better. At that age, had to feel safer. I also forgave myself for wanting to feel my father's shoes and feel connected to him, not knowing at the time of age 3 that his family connection never taught him how to be emotionally connected to his children. Each day I sat, I created a 5 to 10 minute period to let my thoughts drift back to hurtful memories. I tried to look at these memories as compassionate being and rewrite them as I could see them now. I always ended a session with forgiveness and by sending love into my heart. What I learned from this year-long practice was how much hurt I was carrying with me. Very often, I was hurt by situations in my family or school and other parts of my life that were out of my influence or control. I carried with me this powerlessness from those experiences that could be reinvoked by other incidents in my own life. By recognizing the powerlessness, I was able to let go of the story that I caused the situation and create a more nuanced story of being stuck in a place where I had few or no options. And now I still remember some of those stories, but they've been neutralized and no longer carry the charge of shame and humiliation. Along the way, I also forgave others that might have caused my suffering, like the teacher who this was fifth grade, held up my art project in front of the class and said, "This is not how you draw Abraham Lincoln." I also saw repeated patterns of suffering, and I repeatedly had to forgive my father, whose drinking on weekends made me tiptoe around him, fearful of incurring his wrath, and ruining the times when his own shame and anger were physically taken out on me. I gained agency through this process of examining memories, rewriting them, and forgiving all involved, most of all, forgiving myself. I didn't keep a diary of this process because I didn't need or want to keep a written reminder of the suffering in my life, big and small. At the end, I felt cleansed in many ways, although the years since have added some new insults to my well-being. But practice now allows me to hold on to those hurts a little less firmly, and when discovered, to let them go. So ironically, while shame can only occur by being in relation to others, the aloneness and isolation that shame causes us to lose our connection to all beings. As the ego monstrously takes over, it pushes away the very thing that nurtures us. The antidote to secrecy, silence, and shame is vulnerability, openness, and compassion. Shame cannot exist if we can hold on to our interconnection with all beings. In the Zen morning service, we acknowledge suffering in our lives in order to free it from continuing. By acknowledging my shame, I have the chance of liberating myself and others from its grip. Our chant starts, all my ancient twisted karma, all the experiences I have had, good or bad, filtered through the experience of family, friends, community, and society. From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, all suffering begins from these three poisons. And delusion occurs when we do not acknowledge the impermanence of our ego. From delusion, greed and hate grow as we try to protect the ego at all times. Born through body, speech, and mind, we interact with these fellow beings, our fellow beings, through what we do, what we say, and what we think. And the final part of the chant is, I now fully avow. I will acknowledge and reflect in my daily life these influences and how I affect others and how myself as I live in Buddha's path. So all my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. Thank you, everyone.
Alan, thank you so much for that talk. And so as we close,